We're in John chapter 4, and begin reading in verse 5, read down to verse number 10. Then cometh he being Jesus, to a city of Samaria, which is called Sychar, near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Now Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, sat thus on the well, and it was about the sixth hour. Now, just to tell you, that verse 6 made a little bit more sense to me as I began thinking about where we're at in the timeline here. There cometh a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus said to her, give me to drink. For his disciples were gone away into the city to buy meat. Then said the woman of Samaria to him, how is it that thou, being a Jew, hast a drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. Jesus answered and said to her, if thou knewest the gift of God, and who it is that said to thee, give me to drink, thou wouldest have asked of him, and he would have given thee living water. Now, this time frame that we're in right now in John chapter 4, Jesus is transitioning from his ministry from Judea up to Galilee. Now, let me give you just a little timeline, just refresh your memory and get us kind of back in track what we're thinking. As we look at this timeline together, we're about right here in the life of Jesus. Okay, almost one whole year into his ministry. Okay, and about halfway from Passover to Passover. Maybe not quite halfway, but right in here. We've talked about Nicodemus. We talked about the cleansing of the temple that happened right around the Passover. We talked about Nicodemus who came to him at night. And then John the Baptist and Jesus shared ministry time together. Maybe for a little while, maybe for a few months. The Bible's not clear how long. But then John the Baptist is in prison. And that becomes an impetus or the motivation of Jesus transitioning his ministry from the southern part of Israel, moving it north up into Galilee. And really, as you study the life of Jesus, Galilee is his main really area of service. Most of the things we talk about what Jesus did, he did in Galilee, in the northern part of the nation. Now, what I find interesting here is what precedes the visit with the Samaritan woman is the imprisonment of John. That kind of motivates Jesus. He says, I must needs go through Samaria. But John the Baptist is going to be beheaded almost a year later, maybe a year and a few months later. But John the Baptist is in prison at this time. Now, what we read in chapter 4, in verse number 4, notice what it says here. It says about Jesus, and he must needs go through Samaria. And that's a loaded verse for several reasons. One is, often, maybe not often, but there's two ways to get to Galilee. There is the easy way, the short way, which is go right through Samaria up into Galilee. And then there's the way that some went because they had no dealings with Samaritans. They would go across the Jordan River, up through an area called Perea, and then back into Galilee. That was another kind of a Jewish area. And that's probably where John the Baptist was in prison. So the Bible says Jesus must needs go through Samaria. Well, one is he had to go through Samaria to get to Galilee. Well, he could have went around, but I mean, that was the off-traveled path. So some say, well, he was just traveling through Samaria to get to Galilee. And that is true, he was traveling through Samaria. But I think there's a lot more in that verse simply saying that that was a path of travel. I think what it's saying is that Jesus had a reason, a purpose, to go through Samaria. And I think the purpose and the reason, one of the purpose and reason, was the Samaritan woman. That was what he was thinking. I need to reach these people. Now, as such, in this transition from Judah to Galilee, as such, he travels through Samaria on his way to Galilee. And I think it's evident as we read chapter 4, this is more than a passing through. There's a higher purpose to what Jesus is doing here. And here's what I find. Now, this is all introduction, okay? In case you're wondering, I haven't put anything on the board for you to write down. So just this is all introduction right now. Now, when we come to chapter 4 and verse 6, notice what it says. Now, Jacob's well was there. Jesus, therefore, being wearied with his journey, sat thus on the well, and it was about the sixth hour, about noon, that's what it would be. So Jesus is resting at this well. I think one reason he's resting at this well is because he knows who's going to show up. Samaritan woman. Now also, what I find interesting is this, his disciples are not resting. I want you to think about that for a moment. Because often in the ministry of Jesus, They're resting and he isn't. Remember, he's praying, they're sleeping. Remember when he's busy and they're like, Jesus, send these people away. He said, no, let's feed them. Jesus seemed to be kind of an overachiever when it came to those things. He wasn't someone that seemed to get tired. I mean, he was 100% human, but his human side seemed to be pretty physically fit. He was a carpenter. That was a hard labor, so it seems he was in good condition. Plus, he was in some ways, a perfect man. He didn't have a sinful side to him, didn't have that issue. And so he seemed to have good health, and he was going on and on. But in this case, the Bible says he's wearied, and then it says about his disciples in verse 8, his disciples were gone away in the city to buy meat. They seem to have even more energy. Hey, I know it's been a long journey. Let's go get something to eat. And so it seems like there's more to this at the well than simply he's tired. I think that's part of it, because he says being weary. But I think there's more going on. I think part of that is this divine appointment with the Samaritan woman. Now, as we think about that, probably the obvious application is this. We always ought to be on the lookout for opportunities to minister. Always on the lookout. Now, I'll tell you, there's some folks in our church who are real good at that. I'm not one of them. My problem is this. First thing we always want to do is make excuses, right? So let's make an excuse for why I fail at this. I get so caught up in the analytical, logical, I'm doing this, that I get tunnel vision about what I'm doing. I mean, I'll be like, we were walking somewhere, my wife and I. Oh, we're walking through Crocker Park, and probably about where Debbie is, there was a family where the Littners are. There was a family. But I said, Debbie, because there happened to be a woman, and she fell. I mean, she fell about right where you're at. Doom. I mean, it's just like, now fortunately, there's other people with her to help her up. But I, to be honest, I can be this way and see that and not even think twice. I'm at Crocker Park walking. He's like, Okay, I gotta think about what's happening around me. Now, we have some folks, I think, for example, the Chomas are good at that. We've been out with them. They're very aware of people around them. I know Brother Becker is good at that. I've been around him. He's always handing out tracts. So that is, I think, one of the best lessons we can learn. Even here he is tired, he's weary, but he's looking for opportunities to witness. I think that's a good lesson for us. Always being on the lookout for souls. It's a good lesson for me. Something I need. And maybe it helps you as well. But I think there's something else here. What preceded this journey into Samaria? Dun, 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 dun. What happened prior to this? Who was in prison? John the Baptist. Now, was there any connection between Jesus and John? First cousins. What else? Their ministry was connected, was it not? Who baptized Jesus? John the Baptist. Who was the forerunner? John the Baptist. Who was ministering kind of not real close together, but in a similar area? John the Baptist was baptizing. Jesus, even though he wasn't technically baptized, the disciples were, but there's baptizing going on. And so you had this connection between Jesus and John. And now John is what? Arrested. He's in prison, correct? Now I think that also plays a role. Because really the only time you see Jesus weary, absent of his disciples, typically you see the disciples kind of weary, but this is one of the few times you see Jesus looking like he has some deficit, I think I said that word appropriately, deficit in his response and his go get him. He's almost like, he's laggering or slowing down here. And so what I think we find is this. Not only is it the weariness of the journey, of the travel, the time of the day, but I think it's interesting that it comes right after the arrest of John. And maybe this is what's weighing down on him. Now, whether it is or not, what I'm going to say next is true. And that is this. I'm going to show you a Bible example of this. Now, I want you to listen to this. Our spiritual lives, what I'm about to say is very important. It's a very practical point. I want you to get it. Our spiritual lives and our physical lives affect each other. They do. If you are physically exhausted, physically down, physically sick, physically stressed, it is going to affect you spiritually. And when you're spiritually down, it can affect you physically. They are connected. You can't divorce parts of your body that way. Now, if I were to ask you in the Bible, who is probably the best candidate of an illustration of this? Here's who I would choose. Elijah. Remember the Mount Carmel experience? Chopped the head of the false priest. Remember he calls the fire down, boom, like a mini atomic bomb. Shoof! There goes the offering. The water's gone. The everything, the wood is gone. It just licks up. Even the water in the trench, it's all gone. It's like poosh. And the people are like, the Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God. He rallies the people. It looks like revival's about to break out. Ahab is heading back to Jezreel because he's thinking, man, that's kind of not. I had to stay. So he's heading to Jezreel, and Elijah's chasing him. Now, go with me to 1 Kings. Hold your place in John 4. Go with me to 1 Kings. Now, this is an exciting time for Elijah. It looks like that the nation is on the brink of revival. Boy, they're going to turn back to the Lord, get rid of all the false worship and everything. It's exciting. 1 Kings in the Old Testament. It's after 2 Samuel. Before 1 Chronicles. I keep talking because I'm trying to find it. 1 Kings 19, I found it. Trust you have. Look what happens here. Look at verse 1. Well, let's go back to verse 46 of 18. And the hand of the Lord was on Elijah, and he girded up his loins and ran before Ahab to the entrance of Jezreel. That's not like nearby. It's not like around the corner. So it's some distance here. And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, and with all how he had slain all the prophets with the sword. Now what happens next? Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, so let the gods do to me, and more also, watch this, if I make not thy life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. You've just chopped off the head of 400 plus priests. One woman stands up and says, I'm going to get you, Elijah. What do you think he should have said? Bring it on! Man, I'm not worried about you. That's not his response. Watch what happens. Verse 3. And when he saw that, he arose and went for his life and came to Beersheba. I think that's like 90 miles away, if I remember correctly. Which belonged to Judah, and left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness, another day away, and came and sat down in a juniper tree. And watch this. And he requested for himself that he might die. You know why? Doesn't say anything about eating. Doesn't say anything about sleeping. He is physically wrecked. I just want to die. And he said, it is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life. I'm not better than my fathers. But watch what happened. And as he lay and slept under a juniper tree, behold, then an angel touched him and said, arise and what? And he looked, and behold, there was a cake baked on the coals and a cruse of water on his head. And he ate and drank and laid him down again. And the angel of the Lord came again the second time and touched him and said, arise and eat, for the journey is too great for thee. And then he sends him on this 40-day journey down to Mount Oreb, and then you have this where he hears the voice of God, so forth and so on. But what you find with Elijah is this. Why would Elijah, after a great victory, chopping the heads off the false prophets, the people seem to turn him back to God, one woman stands up and says, Elijah, I'm going to get you. And he takes off running. And he, now, within a short few days from great victory, he's like, I just want to die. You know what it is? It's not that he hates God or doesn't believe God. He has physically destroyed his health, and spiritually, he's in trouble. That means we need to think about our bodies. Yes, it's the temple of God. Yes, we ought to be thoughtful about it. We ought to be stewards of our health. But understand this. You destroy your health, you're not going to do much for the Lord either. So we ought to be thoughtful about those things and say, no, I do need to, here's what I found. There are times when middle of the day, I'm like, now I'm like, you know what the problem is? I'm hungry. Eat something, and I'm like, let's go get them. It changes your perspective, especially if it's a nice big burger. Anyways, go on. What's that? Cake, yes, cake. Big cake. A lot of cake. Now, and so I think that's an important thing. Now, listen to the statement, then we'll get into the actual Samaritan thing. Now, listen to this statement. Avoid making spiritual decisions when you are physically distressed. Now, people get themselves in trouble. They get hurt physically, they get down physically, they get sick. And all of a sudden, they're trying to make some spiritual decisions, and it's all bad. Okay? Be careful about those things. So some words of wisdom there. Hopefully it'll help you. Now let's get back to our study, back to John chapter 4. Now, we divide it up into three lessons. One is Jesus and the Samaritan, just so we understand some background. Then Jesus and witnessing, and then Jesus and the ministry. Let's talk a little bit about, first of all, about Jesus and the Samaritans. Here's the first thing. Three things I want you to understand. Here's the first. The Samaritans, because some people say, well, who are the Samaritans? Okay, you read about those in the Bible. Who are they? Well, the Samaritans were the Israelite inhabitants of the northern kingdom. Now we're talking about Old Testament. In the Old Testament, the northern kingdom was separated from the southern kingdom. The southern kingdom kept the name, or took the name Judah. The northern kingdom had particularly what's called Israel, but also was called Samaria, because that was the capital city. So it was Samaria was also the name of the northern kingdom, and the Samaritans were those people up north. You say, well, what's the problem? You know, was it like a civil war? You know, the southern people had grits and the northern people didn't, and, you know, that they got mad. What was it? Well, there's more to it than that. The Assyrians, which was a heathen kingdom, came in and conquered the northern kingdom of Israel, the Samaritans. Now, here's what Assyria would do. Okay? They didn't conquer the southern part. That was the Babylonians later. The Assyrians were very vicious people. Stories are told in history that when they would come into a city, they would actually take babies. And I'm not trying to be gross. I'm just telling you. I'm just trying to get you to understand how vicious they were. They'd take babies by the feet and just bash their head in against a stone and just leave them alone. They used to take their enemies and just chop their heads off in big piles of skulls. And then they'd take their chariots and plow through them, let them go flying. I mean, they were vicious, vicious, bloody people. Now, just as a side note, the capital city was called Nineveh. Guess who had to go to Nineveh? Jonah. This is years before that. It's one of the reasons Jonah didn't want to go there. But the Assyrians came in. They conquered the northern kingdom. And one of the other things they do is this. Okay, let's say Doug was an Israelite in the northern kingdom. So they would take the captive out, and they would bring them over here to another country and say, now you're going to live here. Okay? This is no longer where you're at. And then they take people from that country, we'll say it was Chad, and they would take this guy, and they would say, now you're going to live over here in the northern kingdom. And you sit there. And the idea was, if you were not comfortable where you lived, then you wouldn't give them any rebellion. Well, it had some ups, but it had some downs as well. Now, these became what is in the New Testament known as Samaritans. They weren't the Israelites. These are people the Assyrians took out of other countries and brought them to the northern. And they didn't have Jewish blood, but they intermarried with other Jewish people. And they were kind of like a mixed group. And the southern people, who were purebred, despised them. Because not only did they mix race, but they mixed religion. They brought in all this false religion. Thank you there. You can go back to your lands and join back to your people. We've released you. You are free now. So, yeah, in fact, let me just show you what I mean by that. Go with me to 2 Kings so you see where this is in the Bible. Maybe if you're reading this, then the light will come on and you say, oh, yeah, that's I remember that. 2 Kings 17. So this is the history of the Samaritans. This is why there's an issue between the Jews and Samaritans. It's not simply they live in different sections of countries. There is the, I know these are somewhat charged terms, but I'm just using them so you understand. There's a purebred Jewish people down south in Judea and in Galilee, but in the middle in Samaria would be the mixed breed, and they just despised them. 2 Kings 17, look with me in verse 24. And the king of Assyria brought men from Babylon and from Cuthah and from Ava and from Hamath and from Sepharvaim, whatever, and placed them in the Illyria, we'll say that, and placed them in the cities of Samaria instead of the children of Israel, and they possessed Samaria and dwelt in the cities thereof. And so it was at the beginning of their dwelling there that they feared not the Lord. Therefore the Lord sent lions among them, which slew some of them. Wherefore they spake to the king of Assyria, saying, the nations which thou hast removed and placed in the city of Samaria know not the manner of the God of the land. Therefore he has sent lions among them, and behold, they slay them because they know not the manner of the God of the land. Then the king of Assyria commanded, saying, carry hither one of the priests whom you brought from this, and let them go and dwell there, and let him teach them the manner of the God of the land. And you say what's going on? The priest is going to go to the Samaritans, the new Samaritan breed, mixed breed, and tell them what they're supposed to be doing. Then one of the priests whom they had carried away from Samaria came and dwelt in Bethel and taught them how they should fear the Lord. Howbeit, now watch this, every nation made gods of their own and put them in the houses of the high places, which the Samaritans had made, every nation in their cities wherein they dwelt. And the men of Babylon made Sukkoth-Benoth, and the men of Puth made Nergal, and the men of Hamath made Ashraman, and the Avites made Nibaz, and all these. Okay, verse 32. So they feared the Lord, and made them to themselves the lowest of them priests of the high places, which sacrificed for them in the houses of the high places. They feared the Lord and served their own gods after the manner of the nations whom they carried away from them. It means this: they had an outward worship towards the Lord, but inwardly they had their own religion as well. And the Jews were very much against this. And so it created this. Now, here's what happened. Okay? Eventually, in the southern half, the Babylonians come, they take the Jews out. After about 70 plus years, the Jews, who did not intermingle, come back to where they were taken out of. And the Samaritans, the mixed breed are up. Okay, Samaritans are here, pure breed are here. They come back in. Come back in. And the mixed breed start giving these people a hard time, the purebred. This is our land now. You guys left. We're taking over. What do you think the purebred said? Give you five across your lip. And so all of a sudden now they're fussing and fighting. These would be the days of Nehemiah and Ezra and so forth. So the Jews who return from captivity were at odds with the Samaritans. Now this, okay, so I'm trying to help you understand why this is all going on between the Jews and Samaritans. Okay? So the Samaritans were this mixed breed. The Jews had nothing to do with them. They end up losing their land. They come back. They never mixed with the foreign people. They kept their purity of their race, purity of their religion. And now there's all this fussing going on. Ezra. Well, I'm still in point number one. Ezra. Here we go. Ezra chapter number 4. Now, here's where we see this in practice. Now, when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children in captivity build the temple of the Lord, this is all after they came back from captivity. Then they came to Zerubbabel and to the chief of the fathers and said to them, let us build with you, for we seek your God as you do. Lie. And we do sacrifice in him since the days of Esarhaddon, king of Asher, that's Assyria, which brought us up hither. But Zerubbabel, this goes to the idea of having purity, not mixing up with Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons, chose to serve the Lord of purity and pure religion. But Zerubbabel and Jeshua and the rest of the chief of the fathers of Israel said unto them, ye have nothing to do with us to build a house unto our God, but we ourselves together will build unto the Lord God of Israel, as King Cyrus and King of Persia commanded us. Then the people of the land, these Samaritans, weakened the hands of the people of Judah and troubled them in building. So historically, there's been this long battle between the Samaritans up north, the Jews down south, and they're fighting and fussing with each other. That brings us to John chapter 4 and verse 9. It says this, then said the woman of Samaria to them, how is it that thou, being a Jew, askest a drink of me, which am a woman of Samaria? For the Jews have no dealings with the Samaritans. This has been going on for centuries, for generations. So when Jesus shows up and says to this woman, hey, give me some water, she's like, whoa, this doesn't happen. By the way, that's also why we talk about the Good Samaritan, when the Samaritan helped the Jew. That's why it's also when Jesus said that, the Jews are like, because some Jews would say this, I'd rather die than you know one of the worst insults you could say to a Jew? Call him a Samaritan. That's one of the worst things. Go with me to John chapter 8. Hold your place in John 4. Go with me to John 8. Now, I know you're saying, you've got to have a point to all this. I got it. I'm hoping. Okay, John chapter 8. Me and you both are in the same boat. I've got to have a point to this. John chapter 8, look at me in verse 48. Then answered the Jews and said unto him, talking to Jesus, Say we not well that thou art a what? You understand when he said that? They were insulting Jesus. They were saying, okay, what's the worst thing we can say about you, Jesus? You're a Samaritan. In other words, you're not a true Jew. You don't have true religion. You're a heretic. Everything you're saying is wrong. You are despised by us. That's one of the most hateful things they could say to him. And so there's this hate, this animosity between these two people. Now, go with me to Matthew chapter 10. Here's the point of this whole segment here. Matthew 10. Look with me in verse 5. These 12 Jesus sent forth and commanded them, saying, go not into the way of the Gentiles, and to any city of the Samaritans enter ye not. But go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And as you go preach, saying, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. It almost seems like Jesus has some bigotry here. Well, let's find out. Matthew 15. Matthew 15. Verse 24. We saw this Sunday night. But he answered and said, this is Jesus speaking to this Canaanite woman, this Gentile. But he answered and said, I am not sent but into the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Remember, what did he call this woman? A dog. That's not a very nice thing to say. You say, well, why would he do that? Because here's number three. Something to understand. As you're reading the Bible, as you're trying to wrap your brain around some of these things, here's an important thing to understand. Okay, the presentation of the Messiah was to the Jewish people. Because the Messiah is a Jewish figure. Hang on. Okay. The presentation of the Messiah was to the Jewish people. But when it came to presenting getting the gospel, in other words, when Jesus came, he came to fulfill all of the law and all the prophecy. And the prophecy was about the Jewish Messiah coming. Now, how did the Jews react to the Jewish Messiah? They rejected him, right? And from that day to this day, the gospel primarily has been to what group of people? Gentiles. And that's why the Lord can look at the Jewish people and say, you are guilty. Why? I promised you Messiah. I gave you Messiah. And you rejected the Messiah. And that's why you see today most of the preaching and so forth goes to the Gentile people. Now, go with me to another place. Go with me to Acts. Acts 1:8. Ted, you hold your question, okay? I have not forgotten, but I may cover it in one of these statements. Look at Acts chapter 1, look at verse 8. Notice what he says here. Okay, this is his getting ready to ascend up to heaven. But ye shall receive power after the Holy Ghost has come upon you, and ye shall be witnesses of me both in Jerusalem, yep, in all Judea, yep, and in where? Samaria, and to the uttermost part of the earth. In other words, no longer is the gospel contained just to Jewish people. Now it's throughout the world, to every group, Gentile, Samaritan, Jewish, everywhere. And so the presentation of the Messiah himself was to the Jewish people. That's why we have, right before Easter, you have, we came down from the donkey, remember that? Palm Sunday, thank you. He came down in palm, remember, and the palm leaves? That was the presentation of the Messiah. But when he got ready to crucify, they said, crucify him, wait a minute. They said, he's done nothing wrong. His blood be on us. They rejected their Messiah. And now the gospel has turned. Now, what's interesting is this. After the rapture, then it goes back to the Jew. The Jews will see and realize, wait a minute, he is a Jewish Messiah. And 144,000 in the book of Revelation is 144,000 Jewish evangelists. But anyways, that helps us understand some things here going on speaking the accounts here. Now, let's see if we can go a little bit faster on these next. So that's Jesus and the Samaritans. Give us an idea of the background. Okay, back to John 4. Now let's just look at some pointers here about Jesus and witnessing and Jesus in the ministry. All right, ready? Here's number one. Our witnessing should stress both God's gift and God's Son. How do I know that? Look at John 4, look at verse 10. Jesus answered and said unto her, if thou knewest the gift of God and who it is that said to thee. So when Jesus witnessed, he talked about God's gift and God's Son. Now, as we think about that, understand this. Salvation is not adding Jesus to everything else. Jesus was not being added to the Samaritan's religion. Salvation is trusting Jesus alone. So, when we're witnessing, we're not simply conveying theological facts about Jesus. We should focus on a clear gospel presentation that includes the death, the burial, and the resurrection. Okay, that's witnessing. Witnessing isn't simply talking about Jesus. Witnessing is a presentation of the gospel message. People don't get saved because they know Jesus was born of a virgin. People aren't saved because they know he was born in a manger. People are saved when they realize that they're sinners and there was someone who came and died for them and went to the grave and rose again. Okay, that's the gospel message. Now I'm going a little fast on these. Number two is this. We need to confront this issue of sin clearly and tactfully. Okay, I think we can do both with the Lord's help. Now look what happens in John 4. Look at verse 16. Jesus said to her, "Go call thy husband and come hither." The woman answered and said, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "Thou hast well said, I have no husband, for thou hast had five husbands. And he whom thou hast is not thy husband. And that set us out here." He's pointing out a very grievous sin in her life. But he's doing it tactfully. Because he could have said, "Hey, loosey-goosey woman here. You know, I know you've been in and out of bed with all these guys, but go get the guy you're living with, sleeping with, you know, what you're not supposed to do." And he wasn't obnoxious. He wasn't hateful. He said, "Go call thy husband." She's like, "I don't have one." He's like, "I know." But the acknowledgement was this: "I know that, but I still want you to come." Now, as we think about this, the realization of our sin not only motivates us to turn to Jesus for salvation, but also for sanctification. We are tempted at times when we're witnessing people not to talk about sin much. We talk about Jesus, we talk about heaven, we talk about, you know, ask Him in your heart, but we want to kind of skirt around the sin issue. That is not good. Because the sin issue is why we need salvation. And the sin issue is really, once we're saved, it's the sin issue the Lord's helping us with. We're not immediately, all of a sudden, sin-free. Now, maybe the payment of sin has been taken care of, but not the presence of sin. Do we not still deal with sin in our current life? And so, we need to acknowledge, yes, we have a sin issue, because that's why the Lord's here. Three. Got more to say. Not time to say. Focus on the who of salvation rather than the where of worship. That's exactly what Jesus did. Look at chapter 4, look at verse 20. "Our fathers worshipped in this mountain," that's what she said, "and ye say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Jesus said to her, Woman, believe me, the hour cometh when shall neither in this mountain nor yet at Jerusalem worship the Father. Ye worship, ye know not what. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour cometh, and now is, when the true worshipper shall worship the Father." That's a who. And so forth and so on. It's easy when you're witnessing to someone, and often when you're talking to someone, I've had this, when you're witnessing to them, and maybe you start out and you give them a track and you talk about the church, and it's a kind of a good opener. In fact, the other day, me and Chad were out on Thursday, and I was talking to someone, and I said, "And now the most important thing is the verses right here, because it doesn't matter what church you go to, what matters is when you die, whether you go to heaven or not." But you know what? Many people get stuck over what church they go to. They want to say, "Well, you know, I don't want to go to your church." Okay. But let's talk about Jesus. And so you got the focus is on Jesus. Now, the obvious answer, and I'm not trying to be manipulative, but the obvious conclusion is, if you're in a church that doesn't preach the gospel, you're in the wrong church. But I'm not going to deal with that at the moment. I want to deal with, let's get them saved. Because if they never come to this church, we still want them to get saved, do we not? Let me ask you, is it more important to get people in a church or get people in heaven? Get people in heaven. Okay, that comes the prominent thing, the most important, the priority there. So we want to focus. So it's good to go to church. That is true. But it's necessary to know Christ as your Savior. So that's Jesus in witnessing. That's how he witnessed. Those are some pointers there. So then we have another section that we're dealing with here in the Samaritan woman account. And that is Jesus and the ministry. I want you to notice three quick points about this. Number one is this. The ministry is less about comfort and convenience and more about converts. Look with me in chapter 4, look at verse 27. And upon this came his disciples and marveled that he talked with the woman. We'll come back to that later. Yet no man said, what seekest thou, or why to her, what seekest thou, or to him, why talkest thou with her? The woman then left her water pot and went her way into the city and said to the men, come, see a man which told me all things ever I did. Is not this the Christ? Now look at verse 30. Then they went out of the city and came unto him. That's important because as this is happening, as these people of the city are coming to Jesus, watch what happens. In the meanwhile, his disciples prayed him, saying, Master, eat. But he said unto them, I have meat to eat that you know not of. Therefore said the disciples one another, hath any man brought him out to meat to eat? And he's like, you don't understand. Verse 34, Jesus said unto them, my meat is to do the will of him that sent me and to finish his work. Say not ye, there are yet 4 months, and then cometh harvest? Behold, I say unto you, lift up your eyes. What is he talking about? He's talking about the Samaritans coming out of the city. Lift up your eyes and look on the fields, for they are white already to harvest. What are you talking about? The Samaritans coming out of the city. He's saying, look, lift up. See the big picture here. There's things more important than putting food in your belly or getting some rest. There's something more important going on here. And so what we understand is this. Jesus could see the food the disciples brought him and the Samaritans coming out of the city to him. And obviously he said, this is the more important thing. People getting saved. Ministry is going on. Put the food away. Let's focus on the important thing here. Now, I'll give you two quick points, sub-points. The ministry is not for those who seek plenty of rest, plenty of food, and plenty of comfort. You're not going to do much in the ministry. Because ministry actually takes away from those things. Now, those things may come, and they will come. And I'm saying you can't never eat, you can never have any rest, you can never have any comfort. They will come, but at times, they also must be sacrificed. Here's the reality of the ministry. If you're not willing to sacrifice, give up, go without comfort and food and rest, you're not going to be that successful in ministry. Because it can be a very demanding thing. Number two. I'm talking fast, trust me. Number two is this. Flexibility is essential in the ministry. Essential. Look at verse 39. And many of the Samaritans of that city believed on him for the saying of the woman which testified, he told me all that ever I did. So when the Samaritans were coming to him, they besought him that he would tarry with them, and he abode there 2 days. And many more believed because of his own word, and said to the woman, now we believe, not because of thy saying, for we have heard him ourselves, and know that this is indeed the Christ, the Savior of the world. Now after 2 days, he departed then to went into Galilee. Now, if you go back all the way and you'll find this, that he says, I must need to go through Samaria. The idea was they were going through Samaria to go where? That was the plan. What did they end up doing? They end up staying in Samaria. They had to be flexible. Things changed. So the original plan was to pass through Samaria to get to Galilee, but now they're spending 2 extra days ministering in Samaria. So I'll give you this statement quickly. It is good to have plans. We're not anti-plans. I'm not saying if you have plans, you're some heathen. But you always have to be sensitive to the Spirit's leading. Sometimes even when you're teaching a Sunday school class, and maybe you have 3 points. And you're teaching the first point, and you realize this is the most important point, and you skip the other two. Because a lot of times when I'm preaching, there's things I don't bring out. I know you're saying, I wish there was more times like that. There's things that, there's illustrations I don't use, points, there's things. Now, it's a little bit harder when I have to work the two together, and be a little more creative. But there's often times when you take out stuff, and not only because of time, but because you say, okay, you can tell this is an important. People are responding to this. It seems like the Lord is moving. So you got to be flexible. You can be flexible all the time when you're dealing with people. People. Anytime you're ministering to people, here's what you realize: people are not like robots. They're not programmable. And so if you are inflexible, you're not going to minister well to people because people are like, they're going, it's like, a room full of cats. They're going everywhere. And you just got to say, okay, let's just work and just try to get this accomplished, the Lord's will accomplished here. Now, number three. I want you to notice this. Number three is this. We are either sowing, this one, of all the points, this encouraged me the most, I think. We are either sowing for future reaping, or reaping because of past sowing. Now, I want you to notice what's happening here. Look at chapter 4, verse 36. I read this, and all of a sudden I said, I never noticed this. Look at verse 36. And he that reapeth receiveth wages, and gathereth fruit into life eternal, that both he that soweth and he that reapeth may rejoice together. And the Lord just kind of puts that in there. He that soweth and he that reapeth. And herein is that saying true. One soweth and another reapeth. I sent you to reap that wherein you bestow no labor. Other men labor. You're entered into their labors. You know what that tells me? There was someone working with the Samaritans. That's what he's saying. Others have labored with the Samaritans. Maybe it wasn't you. Maybe you didn't like them. But obviously there's something going on, because when these people heard about Messiah, their heart was turned to it. Their hearts were open to it. And they were responsive to it. So what Jesus is saying is this. Look at what's happening. Let me tell you, it's not because you're such great people. Others have gone before you and put some work and labor into this. Now, I think that's important, because we need to be faithful in sowing, knowing that it is necessary for the reaping, but not necessarily your reaping. Because of our humanity, if we don't see the reaping, we want to quit sowing. I don't get it. Pastor, right? Why do we got to keep doing this? I don't see any results. We don't do it to see the results. We do it because it's right to do it. We go sowing because it's right to go sowing. It may not always be our reaping, but we do faithful sowing because that's part of the Lord's will. And if when we do reap, when things do go well, we don't go like this. Yeah, we got the plan. We got it. We got to figure it out. Look at us. Everyone else. There. Watch us. We're showing you how to do it. That is not it. You know what? When you're reaping, someone else has gone before and sowed. A lot of times people, you think of it, now our church is a little different because we started a church a few years ago. But if you go, let's say a church has been around for a while, and all of a sudden new people come in and things start growing, and people say, look at, you know what, a generation for you, someone paid for that building. Someone labored to put something together. You didn't just walk in and all of a sudden put it up yourself. And so there's always labor before us. Someone has sown, now we're reaping. And that means this. Not only should we be faithful in sowing, but we must be humble in reaping. No, it was necessary for others to have sown before us. And here's what I mean by it. It may be less of us and more of them than we give them credit for. I mean, we're good at giving ourselves credit. We write books about how we do it. We have conferences how we do it. We tell everyone else how we do it. And maybe in heaven God is saying, but you didn't do it. They did it, and you're entering into their labors. So we need to be careful about how we pat ourselves on the back. We might get to heaven and find out there's a whole different perspective on this. Let me give you one final statement. Go back to John chapter 4. Look with me at verse 27. And by the way, when we think about sowing and reaping, then we can be thankful for what everything accomplishes, realizing it's ultimately the Lord, but others before us have gone before us. And we can be thankful the Lord allows us to reap. And if we don't see it, then we say, Lord, I'm thankful that I have opportunities to sow, that your work, hopefully, will be reaped later. Now, John 4, look with me in verse 27. I read this somewhere, and it just kind of stuck out at me, and I thought I would just share it. This is my last thought I'd share with you. And upon this came his disciples, now watch this, and marveled that he talked with the woman. That's really, think about it, isn't that kind of haughty? Can't believe he would talk to her. But what makes you think you are worthy for him to talk to? Because that's really what it is. They're good enough to talk to, but not her. And I think that shows really an issue that's going on here. So the greatest marvel we should have about Jesus is not others to which he speaks, but that he speaks to me. That's what should mark. I can't believe the Lord speaks to me. I can't believe he loves me. I can't believe what he's doing in my life. I think that's the way we ought to look at it.